Good morning. When I walked in this morning, I said it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, and obviously it's feeling a lot like Christmas too. But praise the Lord. He is good. So again, we're back in the book of Ruth. I'd invite you to turn to Ruth chapter 3, starting in verse 18. Ruth chapter 3, around verse 18. Again, hopefully, the plan is next week I will finish the book of Ruth. We will see. There's still so much there. I am amazed as I keep going back to this book and studying this book and reading this book, just how much is there. And I hope you're seeing that, and I hope you've been blessed by this series as we go through the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 3 and verse 18. Let me give you the background again. I know I've repeated this every week, but I'm hoping by the end of the series this will stick with you and you'll be able to say, yes, this is what's going on in chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3. It begins in the days when the judges ruled. This was a very, very dark time for the nation of Israel. A horrible time. Even the judges, we were talking about this morning, some of us, even the judges were very flawed individuals. A very horrible time, and things were very bad for Naomi. She leaves the land, she loses her husband, loses her sons. Very bad times. But there is a bright spot in the midst of the darkness. There is Ruth. Again, in chapter 1, verse 16, Ruth said to her mother-in-law, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." I can't tell you, this last week, my daughters, they're in Awanas, and this is one of the verses they've been memorizing. So they're walking around the house saying this, and I can't tell you how happy that makes me. Just an amazing statement of faith. But she's bright, she's warm, she's happy. Naomi's a little bit like this room, a little chilly, a little cold. In fact, when she gets back home, she says, "Don't call me Naomi. I'm not this pleasant woman you knew. I am Mara because I am very bitter." And why is she very bitter? Because God has done this to me. I left and I was full, and God has brought me back empty and bitter. But God's not done. She might be done, she might be giving up, but God is not. Why? Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And as the story unfolds, Ruth goes, "I'm going to go out to glean in the field." Her mother-in-law says, "Go." And it just so happens, by chance, she ends up in the field of Boaz. And we've been amazed, hopefully you've been amazed, as we see this story, as we see Boaz, he goes out to the field and he sees this woman. Whose woman is that? She automatically has his attention and she has his affection. And we see how Boaz goes above and beyond the laws of gleaning to provide for Ruth and take care of Ruth. In fact, he promises her this: "Don't just be a gleaner. Don't be on the edge of the field. You come in and you work with my girls and you stay with my girls and you travel with them all through the harvest season and glean with them." And she's provided for. Now, we learn that the harvest is coming to a close. And so, questions should start arising. What's going to happen now? The harvest is almost over. Boaz has provided during the harvest, but now what will happen? Naomi was having the same thoughts. And so Naomi concocted a plan. We looked at this last week, starting in the beginning of chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash therefore and anoint yourself and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And Ruth replied, "All that you say, I will do." And this is the plan. And last week we looked at how Ruth did this. She obeyed everything Naomi said. She did exactly as Naomi said, but she did break the script. When Boaz woke up and he was startled by this woman at his feet, Ruth asked Boaz to marry her. Wasn't in the plans, an amazing thing. And he said yes. But we ended last week a cliffhanger, an old-fashioned cliffhanger. "Yes, I will do all that you ask of me. I will do it." But there's one problem. There's one redeemer. There's one relative that's a closer relative than I. And so here we are. We left last week this cliffhanger. What's going to happen? Boaz said yes, but there's one person standing in the way. We'll actually start in verse 14 this morning. Starting in verse 14. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." And he said, "Bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it and measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went in to the city. Now notice, end of verse 13, beginning of verse 14, he says, "Lay here at my feet." Now this sounds familiar because Naomi said the same thing. Go where he lies and go down to his feet and lay at his feet. And we looked last week. Again, a lot of scholars look at the threshing floor and this plan of Naomi and say, what's going on here? It seems a little scandalous that she's going down at his feet and uncovering his feet. And what does that mean? And we looked at that last week. And even the word Naomi used when Naomi commanded her, shakav, which means, it can mean just to lie at the feet, like to rest, but it can have other implications. So some scholars run with that and say, look, inappropriate things were happening at the threshing floor. I don't think that's what was happening. And Boaz wants to make that very clear. The author wants to make that very clear. Because here in verse 14, when it says lay at his feet, it's a different Hebrew word. It's lun. And it just means rest, sleep. Now again, what is going on? Why doesn't he just send her away immediately? Right? He doesn't want anyone to know she's there. It's dark out, it's night, it's just send her away. But again, Boaz is always looking out for her best interest. And to send her away in the middle of the night, especially with barley, could have been very bad. People just thought she was stealing. Remember, this is the harvest time. And so in the harvest time, it was a party. It was a celebration. They're bringing in food. They had an abundance. They had worked hard all day. They'd maybe drink a little too hard at night. And again, he was looking out for her interest to stay and lay at his feet. Now again, as they're lying there, can you imagine the scene? You're woken up at midnight. This woman's at your feet. She asks you to marry her. You say yes. Then you're like, okay, go back to bed. Now I can imagine there was not much sleep taking place, especially for Boaz. Imagine the thoughts that he's having. Daniel Block put it this way, "In the wake of their midnight conversation, neither Ruth nor Boaz probably slept much that night. Boaz's mind probably was preoccupied with plans for resolving the case in the morning and anxieties over whether he would be able to gain the right to Ruth's hand." And I can relate to that. There's periods where I'll go without sleeping. I hardly ever sleep at certain periods because my mind, right? Your mind will get going and you can't stop thinking and you just lie in bed and you toss and turn and your thoughts keep going. I'm sure that's what Boaz was happening, going through his mind right now. And he was thinking, wow, God, look what you have done. This young woman has come to me and asked me to marry her and to redeem her and do these things, but there's this one person in the way. How am I going to resolve this issue? Again, in verse 14, the second part, but it does say, Ruth arose before one could recognize another, and he said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." Last week we looked a little bit, I shared with you how nerdy I was and how geeky I was for finding a PhD dissertation on threshing floors in the ancient Near East. And I began reading this dissertation, and at lunchtime I'd try to talk to my coworkers about this, and they would just get up and leave, and I'd just be by myself. No, they would listen, but they weren't really interested. Again, threshing floors were important places. One, it was the harvest. They lived off of barley and wheat. Two, threshing floors normally had a spiritual significance to them. And oftentimes in these ancient cultures, like the Moabites, Ruth was one of them. Again, threshing floors were spiritual. Their God had provided for them food, and they'll praise their God. And oftentimes in these pagan ancient religions, part of the praise of these gods involved really gross things. And so again, a woman coming to the threshing floor in other cultures, oftentimes the women that would come would be women of the night. And they'd be there for inappropriate reasons. And so part of what Boaz might be saying is, I don't want anyone to know a woman was here at the threshing floor. I did some research and I found the Talmud states, if a man was suspected of having intercourse with a Gentile woman prior to marriage, he could not perform Levirate marriage with her. Now, the Talmud is years later, but the Jewish scholars and rabbis said this: if you're going to be a Levirate marriage, if you're going to go and provide a child for the dead relative, one, it wasn't kosher really to have a Gentile involved in this, but two, you better make sure that you're appropriate. You better make sure that you wait and reserve the sexual relation until marriage takes place. If people hear that you did not wait, that eliminates you. And so again, even though Boaz did not do anything, what would people think? What would they assume based in this culture, based in this dark time in Israel? And so Boaz was very concerned by this. The other thing too, just on a practical note, there's one other redeemer. We don't know if he's interested. We don't know if he's going to want to step up and serve the role as the redeemer. But if he finds out that Boaz, a wealthy, powerful man, is interested in this young lady, he might pretend he's interested. He might act like he's interested to try to get Boaz to maybe sweeten the deal or Boaz to do something for him. And so there's lots of practical reasons, too, why Boaz doesn't want anyone to know that he's there. Again, in verse 15, and he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went in to the city. Notice here there's a sense of urgency. Like I said, he probably didn't sleep. His mind is probably racing. And he's saying what? He measured, he put, he went. He clearly wants her to leave. He clearly wants to start the ball rolling in the marriage process. And so there's a sense of urgency he has here. Now here's the question again. He gets 6 measures of barley and puts it in her garment. Why? What is he doing here? What is going on? And the question is, 6 measures, what is that? How much barley is that? We know that the first day she went and gleaned in his field, he overwhelmed her with an amazing amount of barley as a sign of saying, you have found favor in my eyes. Now, most scholars, they debate, how much was this? The best amount I could come up with was about 60 to 95 pounds. Some think it was just a handful. That wouldn't have been very much. I think it was more than that. Knowing Boaz and how abundant he has been in his generosity to her, I think it was a lot. I think probably about 60 pounds of barley. Now, why? No one really knows. We'll find out in a little bit, but no one really knows. One commentator said, well, maybe they would think that Ruth, knowing how hard she worked during the harvest time, they'd say, look at her, she's still working away. Look at her, she's still going down to the harvest and helping out and bringing back all this barley. Maybe. One scholar said this, and I thought this is very interesting. I think he's onto something. He said there's a connection between 6 scoops and 6 days of the work week. 6 scoops of barley. According to the Ten Commandments, right? According back to the creation account, 6 days he created, 7th day he rested. Exodus chapter 20, 4th commandment. Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy, right? For 6 days you may work, the 7th day you must rest. And I think what's going on here is he's saying, here's 6 scoops. And Boaz is committing, I am not going to rest until I get this figured out. I'm not going to rest until I solve this problem, Ruth. And this makes sense, right? In Ruth 3, verse 1, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? She wants rest for Ruth. In the ancient world, what did that mean? You're provided for, you're protected, you're taken care of. Naomi was getting up in age. What would happen to Ruth when Naomi died? It's a real thought. And she wants to make sure, before I die, before I leave this earth, Ruth, you've been so faithful to me, I want to make sure that you're taken care of. I want you to have rest. Again, this, I think, comes out in the next few verses, starting in verse 16. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. Again, just like with Boaz, there was a sense of urgency. He measured, he put, he went. In verse 16, there's a sense of expectation. She went back, she said, she told. In verse 16, it says, when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? That's an interesting translation. Literally, she's saying, who are you, my daughter? Literal translation, who are you, my daughter? Now, clearly, she knows who she is. But what's going on there? Essentially, Naomi's saying, okay, you followed my plan? Okay, how'd it turn out? Are you my daughter-in-law? Are you still Ruth the Moabite? Or are you soon to be Mrs. Boaz? That's what she's wondering. How successful was my idea? Did it work? Did the plan work out? Let me know. Then she told her that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Now here's a little word of advice, single men in the house. Make sure you have a good relationship with your mother-in-law, right? That's good advice. I have a very good relationship with mine. That's good advice. But notice what's going on here. This is absolutely amazing. Last week, when Ruth went down, she followed every instruction her mother-in-law gave, except for one, that whole proposal of marriage. Naomi never said do that. She said wait until he responds, see what he does. But Ruth broke the script. And why did she do that? When she proposed marriage to Boaz, she was thinking what? Redemption for Naomi. Ruth broke the script. She broke the command from her mother-in-law. She broke the story. She broke it. Why? Because she was thinking about her mother-in-law's best interest. Naomi is saying, I want to find rest for you. And Ruth is saying, I want to find a redeemer for you, Naomi. And what does Boaz do? As he receives this proposal, and clearly I think he's in love with this young woman, Ruth, what does he do? Why does he give the barley for Naomi? I mean, think about this. She is bitter. She's probably not pleasant to be around, and yet Ruth and Boaz continuously are putting her first and blessing her and thinking about her. Remember what she said. Naomi said, I went away full and the Lord has brought me back empty. And I think what God is doing through Boaz is saying, Naomi, you're not going to be empty anymore. And remember all those weeks ago when I talked about this phrase, when she said, I was full and God has brought me back empty. I said, was she really full? Was she when she left? Yes, she had a husband. Yes, she had sons. Yes, it seems like Elimelech was probably well known in the community and probably fairly well to do, but was she really full? And I said, I don't think so. Why? She lacked faith. She was trying to find satisfaction in all these things that the world offered. She had a husband, she had sons, she had money, she had. And I think what God was doing all the way back at the beginning of this book was God was saying, I am going to take these things that you think fill you, and I'm going to empty you of those things so you can actually be full for the first time. I think oftentimes God will do that to us. We'll have all these ambitions and dreams and hopes and all these plans, and sometimes God will come and burst those bubbles of ours because they're not what He desires for us. Sometimes He'll break us so He can make us whole and complete. I think that's what He was doing with Naomi. I think now what Boaz is doing, this is a sign. Boaz is saying, okay, you've gone through this. You've hit rock bottom. You blame God for your problems and troubles and trials. And the whole time God was saying, I have something better for you, Naomi. My plan's greater than your plans, Naomi. And Boaz is saying, give this to your mother-in-law. You can't return to her empty-handed. And again, I think at this moment, I think Naomi's really changing from the inside out. I think she's understanding a little bit more now what God has been trying to do. So again, another thing that might be going on here, which I think is very, very important, this is another one of those cultural things that sometimes we miss. Naomi was the legal guardian of Ruth. That's why she's trying to find a husband for Ruth. She has this responsibility to her daughter-in-law. And Daniel Block again points this out. Since Naomi was Ruth's legal guardian, Boaz may even have intended the grain as a down payment of the moar, that is the bride price, paid at the time of betrothal. The moar was often given by the groom at the time of betrothal, not as the purchase price. Women weren't bought and sold. But it was a symbol, it was a promise to prepare for the wedding in good faith and a pledge for the good behavior of the groom toward the bride in the meantime. So in that culture, and we think about this when we think of betrothal, you probably think of Mary and Joseph. They're betrothed to be married. What does that mean? They weren't married yet, they're betrothed. And it seems like they weren't necessarily together. What would happen in this culture is they would work out the man and normally the father of the soon bride would work out an agreement. And a good faith promise would be, here, I will give you this. This is the sign that I will provide for your daughter. I will protect her. I will take care of her. I'll be faithful to her before we get married. And so I think what's going on here is this is kind of unorthodox, right? Ruth is proposing to Boaz. Normally not the way it works. Naomi's normally not the one you'd go to, but there's no man in the picture. But I think what Boaz is saying is, yes, Ruth, I'm saying yes to you, but make sure you give this to your mother-in-law to know my intentions are pure and good, and I will make sure this happens. Now again, as we've been going through this book, I hope when we talk about Boaz, the kinsman redeemer, as we talk about Boaz and how gracious he is and how he goes above and beyond what's required of him, and he lavishes Ruth with all these things, I hope you're seeing Jesus. We've talked about that a lot. Jesus is our ultimate kinsman redeemer. Jesus is the one who's done all these things and provided for us when we were these foreigners and poor and we were the lowest of the low. Again, when I read this, I think this is what's going on. I think this is the moar. I think this is the down payment, so to speak, of saying, I will make sure I marry this woman. And again, when I was thinking about this, when I was studying on this, I was like, wow, do you see the parallels? Do you see what Jesus has done? As he's preparing, he keeps telling his disciples, I'm leaving. I've got to go away. I'm going to my Father's house to prepare a place for you. I'll come back and I'll bring you there and you will be with me. And all that language that Jesus uses over and over again, it's language of marriage. It's language of betrothal. It's language of, I will go prepare a place for you. That's what the groom would do. I will come back for you and I'll bring you back to me. The disciples are so confused. They didn't get it. Why are you leaving us, Jesus? We don't want you to leave. But what's going on here? What's happening? He gives them a moar, doesn't he? He gives us a moar. What does he do? I will send you my spirit. That's the deposit. That's the down payment, isn't it? Jesus is going to prepare a place for us. He's coming back towards us. The groom is going to return for his bride. What an awesome day that will be. In the meantime, what does he do? I'm giving you my spirit. I'm giving my spirit. What an amazing thing that Jesus has done for us. Again, going back to the story, verse 18, she replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. Now with that, these are the last words we hear from Naomi. Ruth has already spoken her last words. These are the last words of Naomi. And what great last words. The prayer that she had, what she really desired for her daughter-in-law, is being fulfilled. She knows it. The man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. Now in chapter 4, Ruth and Naomi, they're in the background now. Now it's all on Boaz. And we're going to see a lot more from Boaz than we have before. Starting in verse 1. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, turn aside, friends, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here, in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there's no one beside you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Now, the first thing we see is Boaz has gone up to the gate. Now, I have a couple pictures. I thought it would be worth having the pictures. We have it. Ta-da! Do you see that? Okay, this is Gezer. Every time I want to see it, I want to say Gezer, but that'll be me in a few more years. This is Gezer. This is Gezer. This is the ancient city gate of Gezer. I was there this summer. You can see it. This right here is actually from the time period of Solomon. How can I tell? It's a six-chamber gate. If it has four chambers, it's David. Six, it's Solomon. If it has two, it was prior to David. That's how they normally date things. But you'd come into the gate, and I mentioned this before, the city gates were so important. This is where everything took place. If you were a visitor, where would you go first? The city gates. If you wanted to sell something, where would you go? The city gates. If you just wanted to catch up and maybe gossip a little bit, where would you go? The city gates. Everything took place at the city gates. And so he goes to the city gate. It says he sat down there. I have another picture. There it is. That's not me. I was here. I've been right in that location. I tried to find the picture of me sitting there, and I could not. So Google was very helpful. This is some guy. His name's Galen, if you want to know. Sitting there, and what happens is this. In the city gates, in almost all the ancient ruins I went to this summer, they would have these chambers, and in the chambers they would have, sometimes if it was nice, it'd be plastered still, but they'd have at least rocks set up where you could go and sit down. And so sometimes if you were a traveler and you're worn out and tired from traveling, you'd go and you would sit down. But oftentimes, if you had an issue you wanted to settle, a business dealing, if you wanted a judgment on an issue, a dispute, you would go to the city gate and you'd sit down. And that's exactly what Boaz was doing. Can you picture it? And he sits down. Now, this is the amazing thing, and we've seen this before. He sits down because he has something he wants to deal with. And it says, and behold, the Redeemer, of whom Boaz has spoken, walked by. I mean, isn't this funny, right? And it just so happens that Ruth shows up in the field of Boaz. And 2:4, what did it say? And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he went to that field. And behold, look, it just happens. Voila, right? Abracadabra, there it is. Now, we know what that is, right? This is the author's way of saying, look what God is doing. Do you see the hand of God? And it just so happens Ruth showed up in the field of Boaz, one of the closest relatives of Elimelech. No, God's orchestrating this. And behold, Boaz just happened to come from... No, God is behind this. And now he just spoke of this Redeemer. He goes to the gates to settle the matter. And behold, the Redeemer shows up. Now, this is quite funny, actually, in verse 1, the second part. It says, so Boaz said, turn aside, friend. Sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. Now, this is funny because it says, turn aside, friend. That's not what it says. The Hebrew, it's an interesting phrase. It says, Poloni Ammoni. Poloni Ammoni. Different commentators translated this differently. One said, Mr. So-and-so. One said, hey, you. One said, hey, what's your face? One commentator said, hey, nobody special. That's what it means. It doesn't mean friend. They translated it that way because I think they didn't want to make Boaz sound mean. But he's saying, hey, nobody special. Hey, you, come over here. Now, again, why is that happening? One thing that's very interesting, and we'll get more into this next week, the author of this book, which I believe was Samuel the prophet, he's very interested in names. In the first chapter, 7 names are given. In the last chapter, 7 names are given. He's very interested in names. He's very focused on names. So why is it that this closer Redeemer, this one guy, is kind of nameless? Hey, nobody special. Get over here. Now, what's happening there? Now, some speculate that this was a sign of respect. Because this is a spoiler alert, but he's not going to redeem her, okay? And so here he is. He has a chance to redeem. He has a chance to be part of this cool thing that God is doing, and he doesn't. And so in order to respect that person's family and not bring disgrace upon them, they use this anonymous, nobody special. Some say, no, this is a slight. Oftentimes this works like this. In the Bible, if it doesn't mention the person's name, like you go back to the book of Exodus, what Pharaoh was in charge during that time? Doesn't say. Why? Just says Pharaoh. It doesn't tell us which one. Now, as a Bible scholar, it would have been very helpful. God, it would have been very helpful if you told us which Pharaoh. But it doesn't. Why? It's a slight. It's a sign of dishonor. Like, Pharaoh, you think you're so important. We're just going to call you Pharaoh. We're not even going to mention your name. It mentions Yahweh all the time in the book of Exodus, but doesn't mention Pharaoh. And so what's going on here? I'm not sure. I personally take kind of a third option. I think saying, hey, nobody's special, I think that's important. Because I think what's going on here is it's contrasting this closer relative to Boaz. And saying, this guy, yeah, he's the closest relative. He's the one who has the right to redeem. But compared to Boaz, no comparison. Boaz is far superior to him. It tells us he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Now notice what's happening here. Boaz shows up. And Boaz, by the way, means in him is strength. We haven't seen much of this, have we? We've seen this caring, tender, loving Boaz. But he shows up at the city gates to do business. And what is he doing? Nobody special. Sit here. Elders, come here. Sit down. Do you see the strength? Do you see the authority? Do you see the power? We see the love and caring and kindness. We've seen that already. Now we're seeing another side of Boaz. And it's kind of impressive. And you've got to realize, this is the harvest time. This is the busiest time of year for them. And Boaz is taking the other leaders of the city saying, stop, I need you here. Sit down. And they do it. They're listening to him. This tells you what kind of authority he had. Verse 3, then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. When it says the parcel of land, literally it's the portion or the allotment of land. Now this goes all the way back to the conquest. When the Israelites came out of Egypt and then they were led by Joshua into the promised land and they took the land, then they allotted to each tribe and each clan and each family of the tribe certain sections of land. This was very important. It's that one-third, that second, the last one-third of the book of Joshua everyone skips over. That part. 8 chapters deals with this. And it was very important to them. It's saying, God has given you this land, and here is where your portion will be. And to keep this portion in the family was a priority. Now, it's funny because it says that she is going to sell the land. Not really. That's not what's going on here. You can't really sell the land. It has to stay in what? The family. This is commanded by God. It's more of a leasing of the land to another relative. We talked about this. The kinsman redeemer would come along. If you got into a hard time and you couldn't afford it and you had to sell yourself into slavery or you were going into poverty, the redeemer would come and redeem the land. But it wouldn't be his. He would lease it from you. He'd be able to produce crops and get the money from the crops. But they had another thing in the law, and this is really fascinating, called the Year of Jubilee. You've probably heard of this before. In the Year of Jubilee, if you got into poverty, you could have that land redeemed, so it'd be used by someone in your family. It'd keep you out of poverty, yet it wouldn't be his, because on the Year of Jubilee, it would go back to you and your ancestors. So this is how the Year of Jubilee is described. The year of emancipation and restoration would be kept every 50 years. For Israel, every 7th year expressed at length the value of the 7th day. We've talked about that, the day of rest, based on creation, based on the 10 commandments. So what they would do is, when they went to the land, God said, listen, to remind you of who I am your God, I've provided you this land. I've provided you with everything you need. Every seventh year, you will not plant your crops. You'll leave it. And that year, I'll take care of you. I'll provide for you on the seventh year. You will trust that I am your provider. And you know what? We don't see them practicing this very often. But it would go on. So you do that every seventh year. When a series of seventh years reached the perfection of seven sevens, the 50th year was heralded by the trumpet of Jubilee, and a whole additional year was set aside as belonging to the Lord. So you'd have 1 year, don't plant any crops, leave the land. Then if it is the 50th year, after seven sevens, the 50th year, you would leave the land again, 2 years in a row. That's trust. That's a lot of faith. And then any debts would be forgiven and canceled. If you were a slave, you'd be set free. If land was redeemed by a relative, it'd go back to the family who lost it. Now, sadly, we don't see this practiced once in the Old Testament. It's mentioned, it's laid out, but it's not practiced. But this is what this is referencing. When it says selling the land, not quite. Boaz had in mind this idea of the year of Jubilee. Now, the amazing thing, the year of Jubilee would start with a blast of a trumpet. And that trumpet blast is also the one given on the Day of Atonement. Jubilee began with atonement. Jubilee would begin by God covering the sins of his people. And again, what is that telling us? What is that communicating to us? Because God has forgiven us. Because God has canceled our debts. We need to do that to others. Doesn't that sound like what Jesus taught? It is. And where is that coming from? It's coming from this principle of Jubilee. Sadly, they didn't follow it in the Old Testament, but we as Christians, in a sense, we can actually live that out by following Christ. He brings the ultimate Jubilee. Now, here's the horrible thing about it. He brings up the land. This is the first time the land's even mentioned. It's the first time it's talked about. And what happens is this. The Redeemer says, sold. That's mine. I will redeem it. Now, again, if you didn't know how the book ends, you'd be like, no, no. This is a horrible scenario. Everything has been leading up perfectly, right? This is the dream scenario. This should be a Nicholas Sparks book. This should be a movie. The Notebook, Ruth, they go together. Because everything's working out perfectly. And now the Redeemer says, I will redeem it. And you just want to say, no, don't redeem it. Polonia-moni, no one likes you. Nobody special. Why? But here's the thing. As Boaz presents it, Naomi comes back from the land with no heir. And so this guy's like, okay, so I redeemed the land. And then the year of Jubilee, when that occurs, she has no heir to take it. And so the rule was this. If there was no heir to pass it on to, when the year of Jubilee came, it would go to you, the Redeemer, and go to your children, and go to your heirs. And so for him, he's like, this is an awesome business opportunity. I can lease the land. I reap the benefit of the produce of the land. And when the year of Jubilee comes, she has no one to give it to, and it'll become mine. And so, of course, he's like, yes, I'll redeem that. But Boaz is a clever businessman. Because what does he say? In verse 5, the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also require Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Verse 6, and the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it myself. Lest I impair my own inheritance, take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Real quick change there. And what is Boaz doing? He presents it first to the kinsman redeemer. That's who this man is. Nobody special is a kinsman redeemer, the closest one. That normally would involve the purchasing of land. But then he takes this other Old Testament concept of levirate marriage, where if you have a brother who dies, the next brother should go and provide an heir for the dead brother. Two different concepts. And Boaz puts them together as one. This is really clever. This is really wise. Now, I think Boaz actually gets it. Because if you're truly going to be a redeemer, if you're truly going to help Naomi, it's not just redeeming the land. That's nice. That's a good thing. But what does she really need? What's a deeper issue? An heir. And again, the kinsman redeemer, the Levirate marriage, all these things, why are they there in the law? Show love for your neighbor. Show love for your family. See, we've seen this from Boaz before, right? He doesn't go by the letter of the law. He goes by the spirit of the law. What's the point of these laws? What's the point of the law of gleaning to take care of the poor and needy? Boaz is saying, but I have more than just that. I can give this poor and needy person a lot more than that, so I will. He's not just going by the letter of the law. He's going by the spirit of the law. And so he says, yes, okay, you're the kinsman, but also, by the way, you should provide an heir. This is brilliant. Because what does the Redeemer do? I cannot do this. You can do it. When it was just the land, he was all about it. But when he realized, oh, I have to provide a child, and that child will get the land on the year of Jubilee, and I'll lose it, I'm out. Now what happens in verse 7 is kind of one of those cool cultural things. I got another picture to help illustrate it. Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. Interesting. I cannot redeem it. Go for it. And then he takes off his sandal and gives it to Boaz. Now I have an ancient sandal here. Boom. There it is. This sandal was discovered in Qumran with the Dead Sea Scrolls. This sandal dates back to the time of Christ. Now again, I was doing research on ancient sandals because I am a nerd. I was doing this, and again, I found ancient sandals from Egypt, all over the place, like thousands of years old ancient sandals. And again, the author, probably Samuel, by the time of Samuel, just three or four generations later, this practice was no longer in use. But it's a very cool thing what's going on here. He takes off his sandal and hands it to Boaz. And that is the sign that Boaz now has the right to redeem. Dirty old stinky sandal. Who cares about that? But when you hear this in the story and you understand the culture, you're like, that is it. It's like that contract saying, hey, I won't sue, I won't do anything, here you go, sign off. That's what this was. He's relinquishing all rights to be the Redeemer and symbolizing the sandal. We see this elsewhere, Genesis 13. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift up your eyes and look for the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. I'll make your offspring as the dust of the earth so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. Arise, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. Some translations literally say, wherever your foot, wherever your sandal goes, I will give it to you. Apparently, in the ancient world, you would walk off in a triangular shape your lot or your land. And a sign that it was yours is you would give your sandal to someone saying, I walk this, it took me 1 hour, this is mine. I walk this, it took me 1 week walk, here's the sandal, it's mine. And that was to ratify the deal. And so again, we see this, he promises Moses, right? When you go into the land I'm taking you, be sure to follow all my commands and obey them. And wherever your sandal goes, that will be yours. He tells Joshua, you're going into this land, and I will be with you, just like I was with my servant Moses. And wherever you go, this will be yours. Here's the deal. You walk it, that sandal means it's yours. And so what's going on here? When he takes off that sandal and hands it to Boaz, everyone's like, yes! Nobody special, get out of here. You can walk off with one sandal. How embarrassing. Because Boaz is the Redeemer. And he will redeem. I think these are the last words of Boaz, verse 9 and 10. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the land of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon, and also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." And the cool thing is this, we're still witnesses to this day. We're still talking about Boaz stepping forward and being the redeemer and providing an heir. Next week we'll see a little bit more about who this heir is, a little bit more about where he's coming from, a little bit more what it means to us today. But what an amazing thing to see God working and moving and how Boaz steps up and is used by him. Let's pray. Dear God, I thank you so much. I thank you for this awesome little book, and I thank you for how we see Boaz and his love and his faithfulness and his kindness displayed over and over again. And now we see him step up. As you've worked and moved, Ruth and Naomi now go into the background, and Boaz, the Redeemer, steps forward. And we see how strong and powerful he is. We see the respect and authority he has, and how he uses it for good. Father God, he did not go by the letter of the law. He went by the spirit of the law. And he's willing to make personal sacrifices. He's willing to give. He's willing to redeem. He's willing to provide an heir, not so that his name would be made great, but the name of another who's deceased would live on. Father God, there's so many lessons we can get from this. I pray, Father God, that you'd use your word. I know you will. It does not return void, but it accomplishes what you desire to accomplish. We love you and we thank you and pray this in your holy name. Amen.